KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Abrupt Climate Change. I talk with Dr. Guy McPherson, Monday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Waypost in Portland. Dr. Guy McPherson is a professor of conservation biology and an author. He'll present his synthesis of the current peer-reviewed research on Earth's recent phase of rapid warming. Again, that's Abrupt Climate Change. I talk with Dr. Guy McPherson, Monday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Waypost, 3120 North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire, and we are trying to contact our guests, so I will introduce them right now. His name is John Michael Greer, and he is a author of many books, fiction and nonfiction. He writes a lot about energy issues and history and things like that. He also has a blog called The Arch Druid Report, and so you can read his writings there. Or he also has articles on if you go online and go to Energy Bulletin, you will get to there's a website on renewal. Talks about environmental issues. So anyway, that is the guest, and the book we're talking about is called Dark Age America. And he predicts, he sort of sees all the signs coming for a new dark age after we are. Right now, we live in an industrial age where we have used up all the resources that took the Earth billions and billions of years to accumulate, mainly oil and fossil fuels and whatever. And, they didn't get in the Earth overnight. And now we have used most of them up in the last 200 or 300 years, and we are facing shortages. We also have used up the carrying capacity of the oceans and the atmosphere and the land to dispose of all the waste products, which is a very important thing, too. So that is... when these things fail, then this is what leads to a new dark age. And one of the reasons is that when you have a lot of surplus energy, I think of energy as something that magnifies human labor. Think of it this way. If you have a big garden, think of how much you can get done with just a hoe and a shovel and hand tools. Well, you can't. If you work very hard and spend a lot of time on it, you can get a pretty good garden growing. If you have a rototiller, you could probably manage a bigger garden. Well, if you have a John Deere combine, you can manage to grow hundreds and hundreds of acres all by yourself. With your machinery and your supply of diesel fuel. So that is what energy does. It magnifies human labor, And so there is a kind of a surplus that ripples through the economy. If you have a society, say you have a village where all the people are, small farmers, small peasants, they can presumably feed themselves, and they have a little bit of food to trade. They can maybe accumulate a little surplus. They have time to, build their homes and do this and that. But they're not going to have a huge kind of layer of bureaucrats and officials and priests or whatever. They'll be kind of all the people who actually do physical work on one level, and you might have a few people sort of managing things. You may have some kind of a priest or a shaman or whatever who will kind of deal with spiritual needs. You will have, you might have a few specialty people. You might have a village baker or whatever. And so, but you're not going to have all the layers of officials and middlemen and people that we have right now. You certainly won't have, marketing specialists or analysts, or you might have, or you won't have marketing specialists, whatever. So a dark age would be a society where that cannot afford to have all these layers of people above the people who actually do the work. And John Michael Greer calls them sort of the intermediaries. They are sort of the middlemen between the middlemen. There's a whole lot of them in a functioning, modern, so-called civilized society. And that is all based on having an energy surplus that creates that society is able to pay for these people. Well, when a society can't pay for them, they kind of do the work unpaid, or that work or that job description does not get filled. So that basically is what a dark age is all about. It's a simplified kind of place. And there are different reasons for this happening. One is that, we are in a period of climate chaos. We can see the beginnings of it right now, and it's not going to go away. All indications are that it will get worse. How worse it will get, we really don't know until it happens. We have different people saying that if the sort of the global temperature hits a certain level, the oceans will rise a certain level, and so at some point, it may rise high enough, and the deserts may spread far enough so that there's really very little human life left at all. We don't know. We won't know until it happens. We can guess, and we can do our best to prevent this from happening. But a lot of it is it's kind of baked into the product already. It's a lot of it is going to happen. And so there we are. And when that does happen, people will be fleeing the coast, fleeing the deserts. And one thing that Greer predicts is that one of his points about climate is that it's not so much temperature, it's rainfall that sort of determines things. And when you have 40 inches or more, you have forests growing. When you have 10 to 40 inches, you have grassland, and when you have less than 10 inches, you have desert. And our Southwest has been made to bloom by having water pumped in from outside. And if that ends, then this is ending already, in a sense, that the Colorado River is getting lower and lower. The Lake Mead, which behind Hoover Dam by Las Vegas is getting lower and lower. When it reaches a certain level or sinks to a certain level, there'll be no water going into the intake pipes, and so Las Vegas will be basically without power. Or severely reduced power. I think they're doing their best to switch to solar, but that takes time. So in his book, Dark Age America, he predicts that in the future that we will have a kind of a great desert that will stretch from the Rocky Mountains all the way to the Great Plains. Then beyond that, you'll have kind of grasslands from the Great Plains to the Alleghenies and south to the Gulf. The Gulf will become kind of the part of the Gulf that is not underwater will become a kind of a tropics. And so what's left will be a kind of... The climate we're used to, the kind of growth economy we're used to, will only survive maybe on the East Coast that's not underwater. We will have topsoil loss, which will all be gone by the year 2050 unless we take great steps to change that. We will have oceans where there are no fish left, of course, without energy to... you can see the fish rebounding if you have if these mammoth fishing vessels do not go out to sea because they don't have the fuel, maybe the fish will rebound. But most of the fish actually that are in the ocean are within 100 or 200 miles of the shore. But if the oceans are rising to kind of flood all the ports, that would make sending any fishing boats kind of very problematical. You also have a question of demographics. In the past, a dark age has been kind of the population has decreased. In fact, the Dark Age that most of us are most familiar with is the one that followed the Roman Empire, the collapse of the Roman Empire, which didn't happen overnight. It took quite a while. But here you have this huge city of Rome, which had, I don't know how many millions of people. And during the Dark Age, it was, not quite deserted, but it was its population was very low because people had all... They left the city, they left the Roman Empire, they kind of headed up into what we think of as Western Europe, which at that time was kind of a virgin land. So there will also be a political unraveling. And the basic cause of this collapse of the political system is that the maintenance costs of capital, and capital in the sense of all our wealth, the entire economy, that it has maintenance costs, and right now they are paid for by the energy surplus we get from using up this sort of nature's treasury. And so when that surplus dwindles away, the maintenance costs outgrow the resources. So you have all these costs and no way to pay for them. And then what happens is that the elites who run things sort of, they keep abandoning parts of their capital, or they, whole neighborhoods are kind of left to wither on the vine. They are just sort of ignored. Countrysides get no help from the cities. This capital, in the sense of the human wealth, the productive part of the nation, kind of shrinks away. So then you have an economic collapse, and here you have the law of diminishing returns comes in. You have the costs of growth rise faster than the benefits. But so those are all the things that Greer sees in his book, The Dark Age America. I wish we were able to get hold of him. I don't know if he can try. There is an email address. I don't know if that'll get to him, but we've tried that. It's not working. Well, I don't know what has gone wrong here. But anyway, that is sort of the basics of this book. And so I really recommend it. And if people want to call in, why don't we open up the phone lines, 503-231-8187. What do you think? Do you think we're headed for a collapse or a kind of a new dark age or what? In a way, you can see our political, I think our political system is in collapse right now. Just look at the present election. You have, on the one hand, you have a buffoon like Donald Trump, who apparently, according to some people, who they think that he is maybe not clinically insane, but kind of bonkers. He is really out of his mind. So that is the one choice. And then on the other hand, you have Hillary Clinton, who, a lot of bad things have been said about her that I am not going to go into. I will say my big complaint about Hillary Clinton is that she is too much in favor of war. That's a past record. There's no denying it. She was in favor of invading Iraq. She was in favor of going into Libya. She was in favor of all these kind of warlike enterprises that the U.S. is engaged in. And so that is a choice. And the fact that both of these candidates, all the polls indicate that they are both extremely unpopular. But here they are. They are the choice. And so you have people telling us, we do have Jill Stein running on the Green Party. We have Gary Johnson running on the Libertarian Party. And they are there. But basically, according to most observers, they have really no chance of winning. So voting for them is sort of, quote, a wasted vote. That I'm not sure exactly what a wasted vote is supposed to be, because to me, election is something like it's like an opinion poll. It's like an opinion poll that has actually results. You know, if somebody calls you up and says, who do you like in this election? If you like Jill Stein, you would say so, because that is your honest opinion, where you wouldn't say, lie and say, well, I like Hillary or I like Donald Trump because they are the most likely to win. So if you think of an election as a kind of an opinion poll, why not be honest about expressing your opinion? But the strategy is, you know, people say, well, you have to vote strategically. And so that is why you need to vote for Hillary Clinton to stop Donald Trump from becoming president. Well, we got a caller. Thomas is on the line. Good morning, Thomas.
Yeah, good morning, Per. It's unfortunate that you haven't been able to get a hold of your author.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to talking to him.
Yeah, well, hopefully, maybe next time or something.
Well, I don't know. Well, that's possible, I suppose. That's an idea. Well, what's on your mind?
Well, I was just thinking about your comments and some of your comments in relation to the gentleman's book, and and I was thinking about the situation you were talking about, all of the vast army of sort of middle management that has emerged in the United States, and the amount that contributes to so-called economic activity. And I started thinking in terms of the term junk jobs and how much human effort is expended in society, how many people get up every day or as many days as they can manage to get up and go into jobs that are essentially either have nominal real value or use to humanity and serving people's needs in society at large, or sort of do it by default because they're addressing problems that wouldn't exist if we had a different structured economy. Case in point, let's say the entirety of the insurance industry. You know, you think about just as a one small thing, you think about automobile insurance and how much we pay for that. And a big amount of the automobile insurance is a big amount of that money that goes into the automobile insurance industry is because of the fact that we don't have single payer health care, and health care is completely out of control as far as the price of health care.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially you're paying a lot of money into an insurance industry because there's a risk that should there be an accident, somebody's going to have all of these giant medical bills. So in other words, you have an entire like protected sort of protection racket industry protecting people from eventualities that wouldn't occur if there was a more sane system in place. And you can go right on down the line. And, you know, you think about the fact that gross domestic product, GDP, is a measurement of all goods, the flow of all quote-unquote goods and quote-unquote services in a society. And it makes absolutely no differentiation between, essentially, if you created an industry of smashing up Ming vases in one place and then shipping them over to another place and gluing them back together and repeating the cycle, you would have created three industries plus a transportation industry.
Oh, that's right, sure.
And that would all be measured as GDP. And so, and it's interesting to note that the gentleman, and his name escapes me at the moment, that even came up with the concept of GDP way back, I think it was in the 30s, talked about the type of fallacies that could be committed and giving an overly concrete or treatment or conceptualization of GDP and talked about just these sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when you combine that with the idea of energy and you think about everyone getting in the morning and getting in their automobiles, because that's largely what we do in the United States, and traveling to these jobs, often junk jobs, and you think about the wasted lifetimes, all of the things that need to be done and can be done, and all this energy-intensive movement to basically create these money exchanges. And of course, anytime you have a business, whether it's any kind of business or any kind of economic activity at all, you have bank deposits and so forth. So the banks make money regardless of the merit of the industry or enterprise that human beings are involved in. So there's this push to just this ever expanding growth of the economy, regardless of what's actually happening, regardless of what undertakings and so forth. And all of that, like you were talking about, comes straight back to energy resource, all of the energy resource. And so we end up with this absurd situation where we've given false concreteness to the concept of money or financial assets, and we completely negate or exteriorize from the equation the real thing that's happening with depletable, finite and depletable real resources on the one hand, and something that's not talked about is a finite and depletable lifetime of human beings.
Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to talk to Greer about was he predicts kind of a bad end for the Internet. And, in fact, I have an article. Ooh. This is from the London Sun, and basically the headline says that computers will use more electricity than the entire world can generate by 2040, tech experts claim. So according to Greer, that the Internet now, which we, make a big deal of, is that basically the Internet kind of does old stuff in a new way, what do you do with the Internet? Well, you can read newspapers, you can send pictures of your kitten to your friends, you can do all these different things, which people did before, but now we do it in a different way, and right now the Internet is subsidized by advertising and this thing and that thing, but eventually if the subsidies go away, then people will kind of abandon the Internet. They will just kind of send pictures of their kittens in the old way.
Wow. What a fascinating scenario, because you're talking about the Internet for better or for worse, being the dominant communicative or social exchange medium for pretty much all societies, modern and even not so modern societies.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I know what you're saying is true, because you know, we have this naive sense that the internet is this very high energy efficient thing, because on our end of our smartphones or our little laptop computers, you know, you plug them into the wall and they just use a little electricity and they've gotten more and more efficient. But there are massive unseen and unthought of by most of us. I mean, there are giant, giant servers that some of them literally, many of them take as much power as a small town.
That's right. Yes.
And so all of this, you know, and the thing is, you talk about information ultimately, other than, you know, sort of aesthetic or humanistic meaning, which is not to be negated, but, you know, nuts and bolts, the value of information exchange only has ultimately meaning in the economy and in our human life to the extent that we are passing on information about something, things, real processes that either sustain or help us get through life and live in the world. And so there's, you know, the information itself is important, but it has to be about something. And if we lose the ability to power, like you say, the power of this communication medium, it's not like we have a backup medium sitting and ready to go. It's not like all the newspapers or the other public forums, and we just simply don't have it. So that's fascinating. And what I've been wondering a lot lately is about the calculation of how much energy do we have the ability right now, if making a concerted effort, to have enough energy from fossil fuels, et cetera, at our fingertips to make the machines, to make the transition to the machines associated with alternative energy technologies? Can we even realistically trans...
Well, that's a very good question. You know, I think that, you know, they say, renewable energy like wind and solar can... do a lot, but they never tell you at what level of consumption they will maintain. In other words, you know, back in the 50s when I was growing up, you know, we used about maybe one third of the energy we use now. You know,
right.
We had a decent life. You had radio, TV, and all that. But at what level will a renewable economy support? And we really don't know. I mean, I think that we're going to have to scale back on some things, and who knows what. But we're not used to scaling back. We're used to adding more and more and more and more.
Well, it's socially rewarded behavior, and there again, it goes back to the idea that, you know, the capitalists and the bankers, they accumulate these token figures, these profits anytime there's an exchange, up or down, forward or backward, anytime there's a differential of flow. So their myopic focus ultimately is just burn and churn, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as like restructuring the economy, I heard a comment, and I haven't investigated it yet, the veracity of this, but it sounds plausible, and that is that, you know, the 15 largest container ships, evidently, the big giant container ships that take those containers with all of the goods and services, the goods and manufacturers between in the oceans of the world, so in other words, like all the junk from China and that comes here and so forth, the 15 largest container ships evidently consume more fossil fuel and emit more greenhouse gas than all of the automobiles on the planet.
Wow.
I think that's exactly the sort of thing that's going to have to stop.
Well, I hear my music playing, so we got to end the show. I just leave with this. I think one of the first things to go will be air travel. But anyway, I am really sorry we didn't have our guest, but I do recommend his book, if you see it in the bookstore, Dark Age America by John Michael Greer. So thank you for listening, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia on, or is it...
I think we're going to go to Flashpoints
this
morning.
Going directly to Flashpoints, so stay tuned, because KBOO is your radio station.
Yes, all right. Thank you very much, Pear. You're a community radio station. An interesting Thursday morning in progress here, just a minute before 10 o'clock. And once again, apologies to not get John Michael Greer on the air Fight the Empire. We'll hopefully get that rescheduled. We do have stuff coming up later on in about a couple hour, actually 1 hour from now at 11. We'll queue up Between the Covers. Today, host Bethany Grabo will be talking with John Corey Whaley, author of the new book, Highly Illogical Behavior, the story of a teen with a severe anxiety disorder who hasn't left the house in over 3 years. And then at 11:30, it'll be Black Book Talk. And we've got Portland-raised author and educator Renee Watson talking about a collective working to preserve and celebrate the home and legacy of poet Langston Hughes. That is all coming up this morning on KBOO. Coming up next, we've got Flashpoints. Stick around.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland, Oregon's first community radio station. 4 years later, in 1968, KBOO was born. After 48 years, KBOO Community Radio is still very much a thriving media hub for Portland and beyond. 2018 will mark 50 years, and KBOO is planning a long line of celebrations now. We need your help. Our top four goals to get started are fundraising, Oregon Historical Society exhibit building, sharing stories in history, and events in celebration. For more information, contact volunteer at kboo.org or Armando Gonzalez at mandosmundo@yahoo.com. We look forward to your help.